From New York City,
The Comedy Cellar and Rethink Production present
Live from America Podcast.
We will make America great again.
How about new, you crazy Dutch bastard?
Live from America Podcast.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
No. Excuse me. Just so you understand.
We can't be the stupid country anymore.
Live from America Podcast.
I believe we can keep the promise of our founding. The idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are, or where you come from, or what you look like, or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try.
It's just words, folks. It's just words.
This is Live from America Podcast with Noam Dorman and Haddam Gab.
All right, good evening and welcome to Live from America Podcast from the Comedy Cellar, New York City. And we have double trouble today. We have two podcasts in the name of one, in the price of one. We have from Unhirable.
Unhirable. Yeah.
Deeply unhirable.
Karen Margolis and Tommy O'Malley, comedians. Welcome to the show.
Tommy O'Malley is probably the best way I've ever heard anyone say Tommy's name.
Also, comedian is not correct, but who's counting? Well, I'm not a comic. I only say that because comics take that
he's
seriously.
He's just a huge cunt.
I was talking about her, but but it's fine. And of course, Deep was here, and Noam Dorman, the one and only. And I like when he start looking at his phone because he means he's researching. He knows exactly. we're going to start. This is what happened every time. We start the show. I prepare for like 2 days. I come and ask two dumb questions. And he started asking great questions. Everybody like put like reviews. It's like, Noam is so intelligent. Damn it.
Do I get good reviews?
You always get stop.
Well, I mean, the other thing about just his questions not being as good as yours is just purely true. I've offered to help him with notes.
Well, this is some things you can't learn.
First of all, my questions are amazing.
But I've never seen my. Nobody sends me my reviews. I don't even know I got reviews.
YouTube comments, keep it going.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Me? I must get bad reviews too.
Shut up, Noam.
Yeah, he knows exactly.
Say more.
I must get so many bad reviews.
No, can I tell you actually why I'm surprised? Because I'm so reactionary. I say such harsh things.
Yeah.
I presume that people are offended.
You talk the way a lot of people. Let me rephrase this. We talk yeah. we talk a lot, like a lot of people want to talk, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the main compliment is like you say what's in your heart, what you believe in, you know?
My wife tells me to go fuck myself.
Well, she's right, but you know.
I think you need that balance in a podcast. That's literally the exact same dynamic. I do like all the booking of the shows. I do all the reading and the research, and then Karen shows up and just steals the show.
I don't like that you agreed that he's better.
I mean, let's just look. What are the common denominators?
I don't know. You guys watch Morning Joe?
Yeah.
No, I don't care for that.
I have in the past just to see what's up.
I don't like them really very much.
Well, I
started watching after I realized they were fucking.
Oh, really?
I just wanted to see what's. Everybody wants to see what's up.
That is such a like
a lady thing. I
want
to tell you after him. I'm going to tell you my Morning Joe story that I told you.
So, I used to love Morning Joe because it was a really good debate, and now they're all on the same side, you know, because they hate Trump. You know, right. Especially because I think it's personal with them.
Yeah, it is.
But now it's like morning. It's like Morning Grudge. And it's not like liking Trump or not liking Trump. It's just not interesting to me to hear five people all bashing Trump. I realize some people really get off on that. Like people hate Trump so much, it's like porn. They just want to see.
Yeah.
But to me, it's not interesting. I mean, they need one person there, Mark Halperin, you know. But he got he was turned out to
rape,
be a
rape me too.
A me, yeah. Although it was years ago. Anyway, but
she should be over it by now.
Grow up, everybody.
The Mark Halperin story actually was that he had done it. And it wasn't, you know, with stuff like, you know, rubbing his hard dick in a secretary's back, stuff like that. And, you know, bad stuff. But he realized he was out of control. He went to get therapy and counseling. And apparently, I had stopped doing it for 10 years. And
did he relapse on?
And did not relapse, as far as we know. He could have.
Uh-huh.
And had been ashamed of himself. So as I'm saying, you know, he didn't rape anybody. He did some unacceptable things, but you know, what if he had stolen something 10 years ago or slapped his kid 10 years ago and said, you know, I felt terrible. It was the worst thing I ever did. Like, it seems to me like the half-life on having done something sexual, but not like even something you could get arrested for, you know, like you get arrested for slapping your kid maybe, but
depends where you live.
It just goes on and on forever. And, you know, so that's why I say that.
Yeah. But it's like, that's a thing that it's dead. But when you say relapse, that's like,
I didn't say relapse.
You said relapse.
I said relapse, but you agree. You seconded
no,
relapse.
No, I said he didn't relapse, as far as I know.
That's right. You used the R word. I guess my point is...
I see why she drives you crazy.
My point is that me too-ing someone is not the same as a drug addiction. I'm not saying that's what your point is, but like, it's not. It speaks to your character, whereas like relapsing on anything else...
I didn't say drug addiction.
But the word relapse invites the comparison.
Well, I think it's about conflating.
Potato.
Wouldn't it be a relapse? I would say relapse.
At me, so no big deal.
It's about conflating shitty behavior with like actual sexual assault. But rubbing your hard dick is a sexual assault. Yeah. Mark.
But that's who you are then. That's how we approach perpetrators.
We talk about Me Too stuff too much. I'm just saying you can make a list of things, moral lapses that you consider in the same category. Beating your kid, you know, coming on too strong with a girl, short of, you know, and stealing. Many, many things. Knocking your wife out in an elevator. You know, like I said.
This is very Scientology.
And you can put all those, let's call them Class C moral lapses or Class B moral lapses. And any of them except for the sex thing, I think if you just come and say, listen, I did it when I was, I'm ashamed of myself. People say, okay, we forgive you. But the Me Too thing, even if it might be less... is somehow we is elevated. We said, no, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you got therapy. Doesn't matter if you stopped. This is forever. You can't work for us 15 years later.
Never.
Do you know why that is? It's because of the women's movement. Sorry, but I worked in a rape crisis center.
That's a nice
center.
Way to put it, yeah.
No, but it literally is because of the women's movement. It's not their fault. It's just that the way that rape crisis movement came up was through the women's movement, so they would not address perpetrators.
Yeah, but now rape is a Class A infraction.
Yes.
And it's a different category.
But now they actually talk about rape as a spectrum, the same as autism, the same as anything else. So it's all on a spectrum of behavior. So shitty behavior can be conflated very easily. But the reason that I think people are so unwilling to give anybody the benefit of the doubt that they could be rehabilitated is because the women's movement says that you can't.
You hate women?
No, I love women.
He does.
I worked in a rape crisis. No. I'm just saying, but that's like the domain of addressing perpetrators is not the rape crisis movement. So like feminism is important for ending rape culture, but like if you're going to actually end rape culture, you have to address perpetrators. And the rape crisis movement is not willing to do that because in their prevention work, they do not engage perpetrators. They won't give services to somebody who's a perpetrator. Well, so that's a huge problem because perpetrators in this society are probably survivors or victims themselves. So, I mean, that's why I think that the conversation is so difficult right now because you have to divorce it from the women's movement and that you can't do that without sounding misogynistic like I have for the last 30
like you just
seconds.
Did, yeah. Well, we have a lot of questions actually from the Me Too.
He's Egyptian, he's used to it. Go ahead.
We have a lot of questions from the Me Too episode. We're going to ask it next week.
Let's do it now.
I don't have it because I wanted to concentrate on Scientology. Okay. But I want to tell you my Morning Joe story before we start. I told it to Norm already, but I didn't. So coming here, you know, before the Me Too actually episode, I was like, you know what? I'm going to prepare, you know, for Norm because he's always ready. I'm going to be ready. So I was like, why is he so good? So it's like, because he listened to Morning Joe. Uh-huh. I figured that. So I'm in my car driving, you know, so I decide to play Morning Joe to prepare myself before I get here, see what maybe they say something different that I didn't know. So I'm downloading Morning Joe and, you know, I'm not looking because I'm driving. And I was like, Morning Joe, smart, funny. And I play. And then they start talking weird. And it's like, and they saying like silly jokes. And I was like, what is this? This is crazy. This can be like smart. I turned out that I downloaded the SNL sketch of Morning Joe instead of the real Morning Joe. So, yeah. That got a better laugh when I said it off the mic.
Well, I was gonna, you know, I'm gonna tell you another way to
really,
tell that
really,
story.
Really good.
Yeah. I went to listen to the morning show and I downloaded the wrong thing. I thought it was I just cut out all the preparation, you know.
No, the best part of that story is when you go and they started saying silly stuff. Oh, so it couldn't have been morning show.
Yeah, it could not.
I thought it was funny, hot time.
Yeah, it's funny.
I
hope that show gets back on track because I'm a big fan.
Well, they have a competition now, which is us. So they better put
morning ho.
All right. So today we're going to talk about Scientology, religion.
Where is she? I'm looking at a room.
Yeah, we told on 8:33, 3 minutes. So we just want to prepare. We want to talk about Scientology a little bit and religion. Do you guys know anything about Scientology?
It's a perpetrator's religion. It'll help cure you. This is perfect segue.
No, I mean, not rich enough to be Scientologist.
No, you don't have to be rich to be a Scientologist.
Oh, but, I mean,
they demand a lot of money.
Yeah.
I know a little bit about it. I mean, it's been around since I was a kid.
Yeah. Would you ever be Scientologist?
Of course not.
Yeah. Oh, because he's Jewish.
It's a hoax.
Are comics Scientologists? I mean,
is there any comic comedian that's Scientologist here?
Not that I know of.
I don't know anybody in Scientology.
Not that
comedy.
I know of.
It's like opposite things.
Will Smith is pretty funny though.
It's not a comic.
Yeah.
So. Is he a Scientologist?
I think so, right?
Yeah, no. He and his wife. Yeah, they started a Scientology school that like went under.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think they're low key about it.
John Travolta, Tom Cruise.
Yeah, no, I know.
The gays.
Yeah, right.
Well, not necessarily.
The closeted gays.
Well, I'm really excited.
Allegedly.
I mean, when I started like learning about Scientology, it's crazy. You know, I learned a lot of things. I tried to get, you know, as I said to Tommy before the show, like a guest for and against, you know, but no luck at all getting anybody from the Church of Scientology here.
I interviewed one once.
Yeah.
Really?
But nobody from the high ranks would come
rank
in.
Rank and file.
You know, they would come in, but later, you know, like in a few months. We'll see.
They're really guarded. They don't want the religion to be misrepresented.
Well, they have
that's why I wanted them to be.
They
here.
Wait for you to say something, yeah. And then they've got lawyers, but if they have to, they'll go on TV and they have like high powered spokespeople, but that's not for like a podcast. That's like for
no. They were said they were willing to go, but
the Church of Scientology.
Yeah, you know, I tried all of them in New York. You know, there's three. You know, so we'll see if they get here. And there's a lot of. I'm just like looking around how many Jews are around before I say there's a lot of similarity between Scientology and Jewish.
I'm leaving.
Say so, more.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about it after we interview our guests. So
No. What are the similarities?
No, I want to introduce Scientology first because you know, and there is similarity to some of the Islam, you know, Muslim religion as well. You know,
like
and
what?
Don't ruin the surprise. I'm prepared today.
That's a good tease, Hatem. I got to hand it to you.
Thank you.
Where is our...
Thank you. So we will be interviewing Miss Karen Priestley.
Is she here?
No. We can just hang out for a minute.
Yeah, she should be in 1 minute back on. So what do you know about Scientology, Tommy? Because you know a lot.
I don't know a lot. Yeah. My friend is a playwright, Christopher Shin, and he's really smart about it. And he turned me on to this article about like the whole thing about exhaustion and what exhaustion is and then taking a walk. It's all like, it's basically like, don't just keep your eye on one thing. You have to keep re-stimulating yourself.
Yeah.
But the way that they frame it is really perpetrator friendly. Like if you're reading this and you have any sort of like violent tendencies, it's like, don't be violent. Don't beat your wife. Take a walk.
Hi. Oh, we can't hear you yet. Hello.
Oh. Yeah.
Hey, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
Oh, hey, our guest is here. Welcome to the show, Karen Priestley,
Thanks.
Author of Escaping Scientology and a True Inside Story. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here with you all.
Thank you. We have Noam Dorman here, Deepo, Karen Margolis, and Tommy O'Malley. And
hi.
I'm Hatem, the one that emailed you. Hi, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Great.
We have a lot
Thanks.
Of questions. We're very, you know, excited and interested to know a lot. First, can you tell us how did you get into Scientology to begin with?
Yeah, interesting question. My husband at the time, Peter Schluss, and I moved to Hollywood in 1980 to really make it in our career. And Peter was a musician and composer. His very first gig in Hollywood was with Cher. She had a band called Black Rose. And he got invited to play by Les Dudek, her boyfriend at the time. And it seemed like everybody that we met in LA in the music business had something to do with Scientology. So they would tell us, you know, you really ought to check it out. It can really help you with your careers. And we never really understood how it could help us with our careers, but that's what we were told. So eventually we ended up going into the Celebrity Center to find out about Scientology. And we started taking some of the basic courses. I mean, when we got involved in Scientology, we were not looking for religion. We were told that Scientology would be a great place to network with other artists, that we could build our communication skills that would help us. I was a designer. He was a musician. So really, it was more about self-help and networking, social networking, than we weren't looking for religion. So that's how we really got involved.
So what, go ahead. You have more
questions? No, go ahead.
So listen, I'm just going to cut to what interests me about this.
Cut to the chase.
Yeah. What are, obviously there's gotta be some insights into human nature that whoever devised this thing understood, because it hooks into people. What is it that hooks into people so effectively? What is his insight?
That is a great question. You know, it depends who you are as an individual, because really Scientology attracts people from two majorly different directions. For example, myself, Peter, and I, we were artists, right? So L. Ron Hubbard wrote a lot of articles, books, tapes regarding the role of the artist in society. And his philosophy was that the artist is the upper echelon of society. He believed that the artist could actually elevate a culture by injecting the artistic, he called it theta or elan vital, life force, into a culture through their art, whether it was dance, acting, visual arts, painting, music, design. And so he actually hooked the creative individual like Peter and I on the role of the artist, because we felt that Scientology had, an approach to life. The goal of Scientology was a world without criminality, without insanity, and without war. So he hit on, he hit the idealistic side of us and told us that as artists, we already, we're going to be treated with red carpet services because we were the artist who could elevate a culture. So in other words, we were very hooked by, this is something bigger than us. Like we could actually change the world. We, who didn't want to do that back in the 70s and 80s? It really hit on the idealistic side. Okay, so that's like one major aspect of attraction. There's other ways. It's like, think of it. When Scientology first came out, it was offering an alternative reality back in the 70s. And a lot of people were looking for alternative realities at that time. So, think about L. Ron Hubbard. He really wasn't very successful in life. If you read his history, he failed at a lot of things. And he actually created an alternative reality, which was Scientology. It's like a sort of an Orwellian 1984 otherworldly sort of a world that was rebelling against the status quo. And so when you think about when he got started, 60s and 70s, people were looking for alternative realities. And with Scientology having the goal of a world without war, criminality, insanity, that attracted a lot of people who were looking for an alternative life. That, it was not a traditional quote unquote religion. It was an alternative way of life. And they also talked about bettering the self. But even within that, the thing that hooks people about Scientology is he addresses you as a spiritual being who has always lived since before the beginning of time. and yet has not been able to hang on to your own immortality. So Scientology, in its philosophy, offers you a bridge to spiritual freedom that includes immortality. So he hooks you into believing that if you follow this carefully taped path, you can actually achieve immortality. So, you know, when you think about that rationally, that makes no sense because you're a mortal person. How can you achieve immortality? But he's talking about the immortality of the spirit.
So like if somebody came to me and said, you know, I have this religion, and in my religion, the restaurant owner is the savior of the world. So, and I'd be like, oh my God, I'm a restaurant owner. And it's like appealing to my vanity. And like, I'm good. I'm an important. And it's like that's awesome to go someplace.
But why is the definition of it is a religion though? I still don't get why the, you know, say it's a religion. Because all religions are based on, like, you know, the afterlife, the good and bad. After, you're going to get rewarded. You have a prophet. You have, you know, can you tell us more about, like, the, you know, the Scientology as a religion? Like, what is it exactly that you need to do? Like, do you pray? Do you, you know, you go to church? Obviously, how do you gain points in Scientology?
That's another great question. First of all, I'm going to cut to the chase with this. I do not believe that. I don't believe that Scientology is a religion.
You don't believe it's a religion?
No.
I know you don't, but I'm saying in their opinion.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I will finish my definition, then I'll switch to theirs. Mm-hmm. Scientology is a cult masquerading as a religion that is actually a business. Mm.
Absolutely.
And a tax-exempt one at that, okay? That is the definition that nearly every person who has left Scientology, who is now a critic, that is the definition that most people embrace, okay? So, but Scientology tells you that they're a religion because they believe that they're addressing you as a spiritual being. So that's number one. They offer a philosophy that says you are a three-part individual, a thetan, which is a spirit, mind, and body. And the three are not the same. Okay. So that now you're getting into the spiritual realm where a person believes that they are not their body, they're a spirit. Mm-hmm. And Scientology tells you that you have you as a spiritual being carry your mind with you from lifetime to lifetime. So there is an aspect of reincarnation involved here that does not include the word reincarnation. They just talk about it coming back lifetime after lifetime. Okay. So there's a spiritual progression and a spiritual life that goes on forever. All right. So that's the basic. They don't pray. There is no God. Mm-hmm. However, in my opinion, Scientology's philosophy is such that you basically are totally immersed in the discovery of the self and spend so much time exploring your mind and yourself as a spiritual being that you could basically say you are worshiping yourself because it's all about you. It's about your self-knowledge, your self-power, and your self-control. So it really puts you in the position of being godlike. And as a matter of fact, you can catch Scientologists talking about the fact that they believe they are godlike.
Oh, wow. That makes a lot of sense.
But Christians think that too, because we're created in God's image. So, I mean, that's not new, but like the thing that's interesting to me about Scientology is that it directly addresses base kind of animalistic impulses. And it seems like it's a religion that I was saying to these guys before that attracts perpetrators because it gives you a path to overcome those impulses. Like for one specific example that I read about, and maybe you can correct me, with this idea of exhaustion, where we carry all these traumas that accumulate over the course of our lives that actually don't amount to more than like 50 or 75 hours total in our lives, but can completely debilitate us. The thing that Scientology tells you to do is to walk through it, to go outside and take a walk, to be physical and to push through the exhaustion because it's not real, because what you're feeling in your body. And it also says, like, if you, the article that I read said, if you get the impulse to hit your wife, make her walk outside in the opposite direction until you both overcome the exhaustion. So that's why I was thinking, like, right now during, like, the Me Too thing, like, all the Scientologists are really silent, but it seems like this is a religion that directly addresses the violent impulses that humans have.
In, like, a really literal way.
By abusing them, maybe, because we know about, like, the sweat boxes and everything that they, like, make you go into if you're gay or whatever.
But, like, the clockwise, counterclockwise thing is so literal. Like, so it's such a literal interpretation of, like, you do one thing, I'll do another, and we'll meet in the middle.
So did you find that there were a lot of people who would identify as being perpetrators or identify their violence more explicitly because they were able to detach themselves from their bodily ego or whatever within Scientology?
Interesting approach to that topic. In actual fact, when they talk about trauma, let's say, let's talk about trauma, or you talked about exhaustion, there is a process that Hubbard devised on how to eliminate, how to deal with exhaustion. But that is a super basic, small element that is sometimes used during, they call it assists, to help people overcome momentary problems. The whole thing about
is that a euphemism for like, sorry, just to interrupt you, but is that a euphemism for like hitting your wife? Would that be a momentary problem?
Well, it depends whether it's a pattern and habitual or if it only happens once, you know, but if you're hitting your wife, Scientology would want to get to the bottom of why you're hitting your wife. And that's what Scientology auditing is all about. The term auditing is what they call their form of counseling. And basically, you can do it with just two people sitting in front of each other doing a Dianetic process based on book one auditing. Or you can do it in a private session with the auditor, who is the counselor, and the individual. And there are very specific processes that are designed to get you through certain areas of travail or difficulty in your life. And each one has an end phenomenon. All right. So that when you work on the bridge to total freedom, Hubbard has all these steps laid out so that if you want to ascend from like your basic ground level person to having the advanced ability of an advanced Scientologist, you would walk all the steps of the bridge and go through these progressively so that you achieve the end phenomenon of each one before you go on to the next. So as regards handling trauma, you know, if you're having trouble with a habit of beating your wife, whatever, obviously you're having difficulty handling anger and handling problems. So the Scientology auditor is going to put you through specific processes to get down to the core of why that is, so that you can get rid of any emotional memories attached to that habit and be free of it.
Is that legit?
Well, that's the point of Scientology auditing.
Right, but are you describing a fraud, or are you describing that something that actually helps people, that aspect of it?
Well, in my opinion, you know, I haven't found it to be a trustworthy process. And so in my opinion, I find that the whole of Scientology auditing has a fraudulent aspect to it.
Well,
and there's a lot of reasons why, because there's so many moving parts to the auditing process, starting with Hubbard's technology, the auditor, the e-meter, the ability to influence the e-meter, the training level of the auditor. There's so many things that can affect it.
My father always felt that, I don't know enough about it, but my father always felt that Freudian psychotherapy was a fraud. And, you know, but I know people who go to psychotherapy and they just really, you know, you can't stop them. They'll go the rest of it. And what you're describing actually seems to play on the same things that therapy seems. You go and you talk about yourself and they make you feel that you're okay. I mean, all these, and it's kind of intoxicating to just sit there for an hour and talk about yourself and have somebody listen to it.
Yeah.
And but the thing is that the therapists, they really believe what they're doing. And I'm wondering if the people that are auditing others in Scientology, is it cynical? Are they doing it as a business, or do they actually really believe they're helping people?
Well, Actually, I think it's both. I really believe that the people that get involved in Scientology, who get trained to be counselors or auditors, I really think that they are good people who have the desire to help. Mm-hmm. But they've bought into the con, and the con is Hubbard and all of his processes and policies and devices that you get wrapped up in, and you pay tens of thousands into the millions of dollars for the training and the services to achieve abilities that you never actually achieve. Scientology, in my opinion, is packaged. Let's put it this way. You could never walk in to a Scientology organization. They call it a church. I call it an organization. You can never walk in and say, I would like to get some counseling, but I can't afford like your prices. Can you work out something for me? Of course not. You have to pay it's the like exact.
That's the similarity between Judaism.
I'm sorry. We're making little ethnic jokes. Go ahead.
You're making ethnic jokes. you have to pay the full price, tens of thousands of dollars just to get just to progress in some of the earliest levels of Scientology.
I have a question for you. You escaped Scientology twice, and then the third time was last time. Did you have to do the Rehabilitation Force Project thing, which is the punishment?
I did.
Were you in the Sea Org, or are you like
I
a
was.
Regular?
So can you tell us about that project?
You
and
were
what?
Because
I don't know how is that legal, but you know, can you tell us about it? And
were you on the boat?
I was not on the ship with LRH.
Yeah.
I have been on the Free Winds.
Uh-huh.
So can you tell us about it? What is it? Because some people don't know. Yeah. Like me.
The Sea Org is it. Well, I'm very impressed that you know about the Sea Org at all. Okay. So
impressed.
Impressed by me, you jerk.
the Sea Organization was created by LRH as, it was a very brilliant strategy on his part, because he needed staff to work for him on the ships. And so he basically recruited all these people to come work on the ship and then didn't pay them anything. Yeah. He told them it was an opportunity to work directly under him to get free training and auditing while they were working on the ship.
Like
so that's
club.
How the started, okay? That was back in the early 60s. But it progressed into the Sea Organization became like the elite core of the internal Scientology group.
Wow.
And became the management directly for L. Ron Hubbard. So a lot of them were messengers. So if you were speaking to messengers, it was like speaking directly to LRH. Mm. So the Sea Org had a great deal of power, and Hubbard entrusted all of his Sea Org staff to actually manage Scientology. So pretty soon, the Sea Org members were referred to as the elite corps, the managers of Scientology.
So what were you doing? What was your job in the Sea Org?
I joined the Sea Org in 1987, right after Hubbard died. Mm. And the very first thing I did, I was at the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. So I had been a voluntary celebrity recruiter already for the Celebrity Center. So after I joined the Sea Org, they sent me away for training to be an executive. And I came back and I was the commanding officer of the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. And then I got promoted over to be the commanding officer of the whole network.
So that's like a big deal in Scientology.
It is. We had 13 Celebrity Centers, London, Paris, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, all over. And our job was to recruit celebrities into Scientology. So my job was to run that whole network.
Wow.
Yeah.
How would you recruit? What was your pitch?
How would we recruit celebrities?
Yeah.
Well, see, I was in a unique position because when my husband Peter and I first got into Scientology, I was a fashion designer and he was a musician and composer. And he was an award-winning composer. He wrote On the Wings of Love. He wrote the theme song to Rambo First Blood Part 2. So he had achieved great success in music at that time, and I opened up a music publishing company to publish his music. So we were on a lot of networks within the Hollywood music industry. So we talked to everybody that we knew about Scientology. So honestly, that's how we started recruiting people into Scientology. We would just bring them into the Celebrity Center.
Tell us some famous people.
And yeah.
Cool. Tell us, name names.
Well, let's see. You know, Peter talked to Cher about Scientology, but she didn't want anything to do with it.
Because she's the best.
You couldn't convince Cher?
Couldn't convince Cher. Oh. She was not at all interested.
Is there anybody that you recruited who's still in it
now? This is the woman who said yes to Sonny Bono.
Good point. actually, Sonny Bono was a Scientologist.
Was he?
Did you know that?
No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Was his widow, too, the one that became a congresswoman?
I don't know.
He became didn't he?
He was, and when he died, I think Mary Bono? I think she became she took his seat. Huh. Yeah. Anyway.
But Cher definitely wanted nothing to do with it.
She's the best.
When Peter worked on the Rambo First Blood Part 2 movie, he got to be really good friends with Frank Stallone. And
Sylvester Stallone's brother who writes music. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. Frank was recording artist and composer. So Peter and I got Frank into Scientology, and we ended up in the studio with Frank working on the Rambo movie, and we met Sylvester Stallone in the studio. Our intention was to talk to him about Scientology, but we couldn't get through the bodyguards.
Mm. No, so he's not that type of guy, though, as far as I understand, Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, I think he's actually a Catholic, as far as I know.
He's Muslim, but...
So, did you meet John Travolta, Tom Cruise?
Are they gay?
I definitely met John Travolta. I was at the Celebrity Center when Tom Cruise was coming in. As a matter of fact, I was there when he got recruited. I didn't recruit him. He was brought in by Mimi Rogers.
Is there something, or is it coincidence, that these celebrities who are reputed to be gay but in the closet,
Will Smith inclusive?
Will Smith? Well, I don't know.
Is that
a false observation, or is there something to that? That these people who are living fake lives or whatever you want to call it, or somehow this is shunted to this kind of thing? I don't know.
You know, a lot of people who come into Scientology have secrets like that. Hmm. And here's the truth. They disclose their secrets in session, and they will talk about everything from, their sexual perversions to their fantasies to whatever. And
that's
why
secrets, they can never leave.
Well, actually, that is exactly right.
Yeah.
Because they do disclose their secrets, and they are written in the worksheets. And that is a factor that keeps some people from leaving, mm-hmm. because Scientology is notorious for disclosing, like digging into folders, like they're doing right now with Paul Haggis, mm-hmm. to frame Paul Haggis.
I don't know who Paul Haggis is. Am I supposed to know?
Crash.
He's like a director.
That
movie
he directed.
Oh.
Wasn't he one of the first people to leave publicly?
He was one of the hardest to leave.
One of the biggest.
One of the first celebrities to leave publicly. Yeah. Jason Begay.
Yes,
who is on Chicago PD. Yeah, Jason Begay is another. Of course, Leah Remini. Leah left after Paul left. Paul left, I think, in 2010, somewhere around there. Jason Begay left around 2008. Mm-hmm. Leah left around 2012 or so. And, of course, Katie Holmes left in around 2013. Nicole Kidman left shortly before that. So between, 2005 and 2010, about five or six major celebrities left.
Nicole Kidman was, a Scientologist until 2013?
No, not until 2013. Okay. She left much earlier.
She left when she divorced. They all leave when they divorce Tom Cruise, right?
Yeah, it looks like Tom Cruise is the best recruiter for a Scientology. Let me ask you something. You can't just leave Scientology, right?
Well, compared to Islam, it's easy to leave Scientology. But
that was a comparison.
it really depends on who you are and how you do it and how you go about it.
Yeah.
In Scientology, you can't just say, I'm done. Thank you very much. See you later. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Because you can if you promise to never publicly disavow it.
Boo.
Okay.
Oh,
but
really?
You are not free to leave and talk about it in the media or in a critical manner to anyone. If you publicly disavow Scientology, they will be after you with attack dogs. And that is no exaggeration. So they're notorious for believing that they have a free license to go after their ex-members if they criticize Scientology in public.
What, do they issue a fatwa or something?
It's like fair game, they call it. Don't they call it fair game? It's like you can do or say whatever.
Exactly right. Yeah. It's fair game.
Yeah.
They say that they say that they canceled the fair game policy. And while they might have canceled it on paper, they definitely did not cancel the practice.
So we're here with the Salman Rushdie of Scientology, by the way. But can I ask? Go ahead. You want to? Go
yeah, I okay. Quick, did you quick. Did you report to David Miscavige? Like, did you deal with him directly?
I dealt with him directly for
it's such a smart,
minutes.
Amazing question.
I don't even know who that is.
He's the guy. He's the tiny leader of Scientology.
You have to tell the listener that nobody knows. No, we don't.
He's the top. Up. Tom Cruise
he's
is the
top,
bottom.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. that was a great question.
Thank you.
Great question.
I did. You asked me how I got into the Sea Org. I did start out at the Celebrity Center, but by about 1990, Peter and I went out to the desert headquarters, which was this confidential location at the time. Nobody else knew what it was. And we went out there, which was headed up by David Miscavige. It's a very cult-like environment. There were about 800 people working out there in the Moreno Valley, just between LA and Palm Springs. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely a cultic headquarters. Mm-hmm. It's actually a nightmare to think about it sometimes. And it was very difficult writing about that period of my life in my book because there was a lot of pain and a lot of trauma involved there. And I did develop PTSD during that time because there was so much psychological abuse and physical abuse. It would blow your mind. But when you read the books or watch the Leah Remini show and listen to the stories of people telling what went on, it's all true.
You did all that stuff with the yelling and the trash cans and the screaming at each other and everything.
I was not in the hole, but my husband, Peter, was in the hole.
Oh, my God.
How do you know so much about Scientology?
Because there's a Tony Ortega, who used to write for The Village Voice, has this like long running like
she's sleeping with him.
Research. Yes, I'm fucking this guy. Called The Underground Bunker. It's like this blog he's been doing for years and years and years. He's like the expert who's not in Scientology about Scientology. And when what's her name? Katie Holmes left. That's when a lot of people got into it. But I read like all his shit and was reading. What's his name? I can't remember if it's Mike Rinder or the other one.
Mike Rinder or Marty Rathbun.
Rathbun, yes. One of them went back.
Marty Rathbun.
Yeah, went back. They were like harassing his wife and stuff. But he had this whole anti-Scientology. He would go on and had started his own like independent practice because he still believed in it, but didn't want to be part of the organization. And they like bought the house across the street from him and would spy. It was crazy what happened to him. He went back in, so I just got curious about it.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing.
Do you hold on to homework. It? You have done your homework.
It's interesting. I can't believe that it happened like now. Do you know what I mean? Like this should just have like all the like where Shelley Miscavige stuff. Like that's wild. People haven't seen David Miscavige's wife, the leader's wife, in like
years.
And then they marched her out for like that's what Leah Remini got in trouble for at Tom Cruise's wedding. She goes, "Where's Shelley?" And like they were like, "That's not your fucking business."
I don't even know what to say to all this. Do they have a no cell phone rule? Like now you can sneak a recorder or video camera anywhere. That's got to cramp their style.
When I was there, now I left in 1998.
Yeah, that's prior.
And you know, from 1989 to 1998, no cell phones were allowed. We could not even access the internet and we could not watch television. Wow. When Peter and I first moved in there, we set up a TV and security took it. They literally absconded it. And we were very, very cut off from the outside at the Imp base. So it's total, you know, 1984 George Orwell level of control. And you are utterly separated from the outside world there.
So when you left Imp base.
Now it might be a little bit different. I don't know if they allow cell phones there now. Not to my knowledge.
So when you left the base in California, you left the base and then Peter left the hole. Like, how did you guys leave physically? Like, logistically, how did you do it? Isn't it like a compound that's like very protected?
It's very protected. It's fenced. It's got armed security guards.
Oh, wow.
And you cannot just walk out.
Yeah.
You have to escape, and you have to plan an escape to get out. Now, I escaped twice, and each time I came back, the second time I went to the RPF, wow. which Hottam or someone asked me that question earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. And yes, I did go to the RPF.
What did you have to do?
Which is the prison camp.
Yeah, and the prison camp for.
I was in the prison camp for 7 months.
Wow.
For leaving.
And
wow.
Yes, for
can't
leaving.
Can't you go to the police about
because that? Because I escaped without authorization.
How is that legal?
And because I wanted to, it isn't legal. They were holding me against my will.
Yeah.
But because they use a certain type of coercion on you, yes, I did sign a document finally that said I will do the program, but I signed it under duress and I signed it under coercion.
Yeah.
And it would never hold up in court, the fact that I signed that document. So you're held against your will. You're in a prison-like setting and you do hard labor for part of the day. You have to run everywhere you go. You get very little sleep and you're treated like a prisoner. You wear all black clothing with a black armband. It's the most degraded, humiliating experience. You have to ask the question, how does anybody in America get away with this?
I'm asking you, why don't the police bust this
thing? This is not Guantanamo, but yet they treat you like you're in Guantanamo. But
why don't the police bust down the door? I don't understand.
There's all these stories about it. Yeah, like people who have escaped, I forgot their names now, but they've written about it. People know. Why are the cops not there?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that those of us that have escaped, we have reported to police.
Yeah.
But when police go to the base, and for example, here's a good example. I heard, okay, to answer your question from earlier, after I did the RPF, the prison camp, I went back to the base and assumed my role with the Sea Org community, okay? And I got back with my husband. During the time that I was in the RPF, Peter and I were separated. So they don't allow spouses to be together whatsoever. So when we got back together, we shared our apartment together again and went on for a couple of years like that until I started to talk to him about leaving again. Now, you asked, how did I get out and how did he stay in there? Mm-hmm. What happened was Peter did not want to leave. And I was talking to him about leaving, escaping and getting our lives back. He did not want to leave. Mm. All right. So that's hard to swallow.
Yeah.
It's hard to fathom, but it's like he was so brainwashed. He was so sold out. He actually believed that he was doing the righteous thing. Mm. He believed that he was a trusted, loyal officer of the Sea Org. And he didn't feel that he could escape. He was afraid that they were going to come after him, and he didn't feel that he would be able to deal with the pressure. And I personally think that he was quite cowardly about the whole thing. And when 1998, when I reached my own breaking point, and I said, you know, I told him that I wanted to leave and he wouldn't leave with me, I left. I literally escaped in the middle of the night with the car, and he did not go with me.
Wow.
Now, after I left was when he was assigned to the hole.
That's because when of he you was leaving. Sent.
That's after I left.
Okay.
He went into the hole. And I don't know how long it was between the time I left and the time he went into the hole, but I know that he was there for more than a couple of years.
Wow. Oh my God.
Is he still your husband?
No.
Inside? Does he hate you? Does he blame you? I mean, like, did you ever talk about that?
Scientology doesn't let you talk to your spouse if your spouse leaves the Sea Org. So there is a very destructive, ugly, evil policy that, you know, if one person leaves and the other one stays, the one that leaves is the bad guy. The one that stays is the good guy and gets all the protection. So the one that leaves is the one that's treated like an enemy, and they call you a suppressive person. Okay. So when I left, we were apart. We never spoke once. And the church forced him to divorce me and to disconnect from me. And this was after a 20-year marriage.
Wow. So
I'm looking at there have been raids.
We got divorced in the mail. The church organized the whole divorce in the mail. So after 20 years, we didn't even have the opportunity to see each other at all or in court or anything.
That's crazy.
Do you keep up any of the practice in your, I guess, civilian life? I don't know what you call it, your post-Scientology life. Are there things that you, routines, whatever practices that you maintain that you thought were beneficial?
I practice nothing of Scientology. And as a matter of fact, I found that the only way I could get my mind back together was to purge all things Scientology from my thought process, from my language, from my behavior, from my habits, and my whole belief system. Like, I went completely cold turkey, purged it all.
Yeah.
Now, not a lot of people do that, but because you're so deeply indoctrinated, you know, like someone who's a Muslim or someone who's a Jew or someone who is any religion that they've been their entire life, it's very difficult to just, you know, cold turkey, turn it all off. Yeah. Stop using the vocabulary, the beliefs, the impulses. But that's what I did because I was so disgusted and disillusioned by the whole con of Scientology that I wanted nothing to do with it, number one. Number two, I felt that that I had really become someone else while I was in Scientology, specifically in the Sea Org. I had really lost who I really am, my own like grip on my own personal basic identity. And so to me, the only way that I could heal and figure out who I really was to completely purge Scientology.
Okay.
And that was not easy.
Last question is, what's next for you now? After your, is a new book coming? What's, you know, I feel like, do you feel obligated to keep defending, you know, your escape from Scientology and let people know the truth story?
You know, I really do. But the reason I really do feel like I'm going to continue activism on exposing Scientology's abuses because I want the abuse to stop. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very active in Facebook groups. I do a lot of interviews. I am working on a second book, but the second book that I'm working on, I started when I went to college after I left Scientology. And that was part of how I reconstructed my mind, is I went back and got an education. Then I went and got a master's degree in writing. And while I was working on my master's degree, I discovered the healing process of writing. So the second book that I'm working on now is to help people who have come out of Scientology to basically come to terms with their story mm-hmm. through the process of writing. So I'm actually working on a book called Writing to Heal.
When should we expect it to come out?
Hopefully this summer.
Okay, great.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be speaking at a international cultic studies event in Philadelphia in July, and I hope to be releasing the book then.
Mazel tov.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It was very interesting. Would you like to share your information for listeners, Twitter or anything?
Oh, please. My website is escapingscientology.com. Mm-hmm. And my book is Escaping Scientology, an Insider's True Story, which you can get on Amazon.
Excellent. And if you ever in New York, come visit us at the Comedy Cellar.
I would love
please
to.
Please do. Please yeah. do.
Well, I would love to.
Well, thank you so much, Do. It's very interesting, and I'm sure we'll have you back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love your format. I love this group discussion.
Thank you. Especially, I have a great questions. Yeah. All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thank you all. You too. Bye.
Bye. Right. So, yeah, we can just keep going. Okay. Look, what do you guys?
What differs this from any other religion? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of similarity. That's what I was trying to say.
I just remember when I did get to like do the pre-interview before the Scientologists would let us interview them on the record. One thing they said is that you can be, it's kind of like Buddhism. You can be a Catholic Scientologist. You can be a Jewish Scientologist. So it's like It's something, it's like a layover. It's like a tool overlay. It's not really a religion. It's just like, it doesn't function. It just is like a thing.
Things that, unless you believe in, you know, in miracles, you know, then every religion is based on a lie, right? And then every religion started with somebody bullshitting about something, I guess. Yeah. I hate to say that.
Yeah, but it's like, it's the same, it's semantic, right? So it's like, when people are like that, you know, religions align everything, that's like irrelevant. Yeah, of course, it's like the miracles and hocus pocus are not the point. Like, the point is, like, it's a utility to, like, separate our group from this group and, like, for self-preservation and to build a community in a certain way that defends against outside threats and preserves it and stuff. Like, the other stuff is just, like, potato, potato.
Listen, not every philosophy is a lie, but, like, let's say Christianity, because, you know, we all, because you can bash Christianity. nobody cares.
No.
So Jesus is supposed to have died on a cross and then rose up and then it disappeared and they went. Yeah. Now people believe that today.
Yeah.
But the people who first said that, they knew it wasn't true.
Yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
really walked in there and said, oh, he was here yesterday and he's gone. Like that. So it had, right? They knew it wasn't true, no?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, Christianity,
maybe
didn't Judaism.
Start maybe I'm simplifying how it actually got started.
No, but of course it has to start with the lie, because unless you believe that that happened, unless you actually literally believe in the ascension.
But people like, can believe and not believe something at the exact same time. Like, people do it all the time.
It's people organizing people to end human suffering.
That's
and
it.
They do it around narratives.
The
like,
people
that's
who
the way
said
we're
the,
able
the
to
first
connect.
People who said Jesus was here, now he's not, now he's back. Could have both known obviously that's not true. They're like, I'm saying this thing, but also somewhere in them, like, to get people to believe you, you have to believe it. Like, if to be a good actor, you have to like believe what you're saying, but you have to have enough of your own mind so you don't go crazy and like lose yourself in.
Well, think about kids.
Nonsense.
It's like the original lie for Christian kids is that Santa Claus is real. But like the point of that for some people is to like teach kids generosity of spirit. But like for other people, it becomes just like pure commercial, like capitalism. So it's just like, it depends on how you approach it.
But I think
it.
this religion, like Scientology, it's the point of you are the God. I think that sells to a lot of people, you know, especially in Hollywood and stuff like that. Like I can see, like, I always wonder, like in the beginning, I know you joined Scientology because you want to help with the career, but I always wonder why famous people like Tom Cruise and, you know, all these people like join. And I can see that. And you can see from their own personalities.
Also, they have a celebrity center that's called the Celebrity Center. Like, they specifically are catering
yeah, but
to
it's
certain
LA.
People to make it. Yeah, but that's the point. It is LA. So they're making it so that for certain people, you get this fun Scientology. And then for people who like really do Scientology, it sucks a fat dick.
Damn.
That's not the best kind of
thing. I never thought that we're going to have a religious conversation. And
which everybody loves. I mean, I know I'm confusing the point. Yeah.
Well, how about we hire you to be like an undercover reporter and you go, you know, yes. We'll wire you and you go to Scientology.
I would be so down.
You will literally become a Scientologist.
I know.
Fully.
I support
reject this.
All of you. I
we're
can
all
no,
suppressive
we cannot
people.
Be speaking. Yeah.
Are you down? That'd be great. We go to Pulitzer here.
Seriously, I'm 100% down. I have no kids. I give no shits. I just need somewhere to do my skincare routine. That's it. Seriously. Well, I mean, then no.
All right. This is how we start. You have to go to the spy store online or whatever it is. And
yeah.
You got to figure, you're going to have to boof it, but you got to get.
What does that mean?
Up the bar.
Oh, Miss Expert doesn't know what
Oh, we're talking about butts. Okay.
You got to find someplace to hide this thing, but you got to find a recorder.
Okay.
Listen, you're doing it
Who's
for America.
Who's paying for it? Okay.
Paying for what?
Who's paying for my new recorder?
Your boofer.
My butt recorder.
I got this.
I'll pay for it.
I do the installation myself.
Deal.
Do I get one too? Wait, why is Karen getting all the boofing?
I'm single. I don't. What do you want from me?
Yeah, but there's got to be some way now with modern technology to really be able to be frisked, but still be recording.
They must make you naked, naked, naked. Like you have to. They must really
they must
inspect you.
I mean,
think of how crazy
you.
They are.
They have money.
Do cavity
so they,
searches.
So you Google and there was rates on.
There were some raids and a lot of raids around the country. One in Tennessee, around the rest. But then I began to read the Quincy Jones interview.
I read the Quincy Jones interview too. It's so good.
They dropped the ball on the Hillary question. I will say that.
He goes in on Michael.
Well, he said something really interesting about Hillary Clinton at the beginning of that interview. He's like, what do you think? He's like, well, when you enter something with lies, and then he goes, what do you mean by that? He goes, oh, we shouldn't talk about that.
Right.
And then the reporter just drops it.
He also said that Paul McCartney's a lousy bass player. That's ridiculous.
I mean, the man would know.
Well, that's the point that a lot of the great bass players think Paul McCartney is a great bass player. Jaco was the greatest bass player ever, maybe one of the greatest, you know, talked about how much he loved Paul McCartney's bass playing. Mm. It just sounds a little like a little bitchy. Like you could say,
well, he's 10,000 years old.
Yeah, you could say, you know, Paul McCartney is a limited bass player or he played well for his songs, whatever you want to say, but say he's a lousy bass player.
Yeah, but now we're talking about it on a podcast where he did the exact right thing.
You know,
country? Michael Jackson, piece of shit. He said it.
He said he was greedy.
The start.
He said he was a greedy thief. Yep. Yeah.
Greedy thief.
What do you mean thief?
Stole music from people, refused to give them money. Like a guy wrote like some hook on a song for him and then he didn't give him 10% of the profits.
Right.
Like something like that.
Did he
say
anything good about anybody?
Yeah,
he said good things about Bono.
Ivanka
not his
has
music,
good legs.
But yeah, Ivanka has good legs. Bono's a good person, but makes shitty music now. what else did he say?
I'm trying to remember. Oprah shouldn't run for president. She's a wonderful person, but you should be a CEO of a company. And the guy was like, she is a CEO of a company. And he was like, meh.
She was like, she can't do it.
All right. Well, anyway, I don't know. Are we done? I guess we're done.
If he did, listen.
How long has it been, Deepu? 1 hour.
Yeah.
1 hour.
Just the.
Quincy Jones is a lamb compared to you.
Well, I hope you guys enjoy Scientology interview. I think it was great. And, you know.
My questions were on fire.
Listen, so, I want to tell you about these interviews.
here's the score.
Wait, I want to tell you something. We can't have. I was fascinated.
Yeah.
But I think we need things we can fight about. Like as a listener, we need to find out and we need to keep the answers. Like we got to get these people.
We do that on our show. We have black people come on and then we talk about black and white shit. That's what people want to hear is black and white shit.
Yeah. Nobody brings it up for real.
In an honest way.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a really crazy episode yesterday. No joke with Von DiCarlo and this rapper Jadon Woodard and this guy. It was like very difficult to have, but we had like a pretty big.
What's the most honest thing that anybody said?
About race yesterday? Mm-hmm. The most honest thing? I guess I have to think about that. I guess the most honest thing was that I said that I was scared to say something in front of black people because I didn't want to be seen as being pejorative or speaking down to them.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I wanted to say, stop arguing. You're just arguing for the sake of arguing. And then I did ultimately say that. Mm-hmm. But it took like coaxing.
You're white-splaining them?
I needed to white-splain some shit and yeah. I was afraid to do it. Yeah. I was intimidated.
Yeah. Well, it is scary to say things.
White people should be more comfortable to say white-splain shit because we have to explain what it's like to be white because that's how we acknowledge that whiteness is a thing.
I think we have to take the Me Too out of race shit and look at intent. Like the Me Too thing is the problem also is that we're conflating things that happen with intent that people had. And I know I don't mean to like shoot myself in the foot and be like, you can accidentally rape or whatever. Like that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But you can get in so much trouble just for saying an honest thing about race that you have to say or coming from your perspective. And people are like, well, yeah, that's privilege. Yeah, I know. But that's where I'm coming from. So just hear me out so we can have a conversation. Do you know what I mean? Like, why should I be punished because I said a thing from my perspective? Like, that's how we talk. My intent's not racist. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to hurt anybody.
Listen, the whole world has embraced the concept of ad hominem attack, meaning that you attack the person who says it. It's like I was arguing about the FISA warrants of all things. And everything I'd bring up, they'd attack this and attack that. Well, you know what? But we had an ACLU attorney here. It's like you gotta put it in the mouth of somebody who can't be attacked personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you have to deal with the logic. And I just think it's ridiculous. It doesn't matter. If it's wrong, you should be able to demonstrate it on the logic. You don't have to attack, like you have to listen to women. Well, which women? The women who agree with you? Or you're not supposed to listen to the women who think this has gone too far or anything like that, right? You have to listen to the women they say you have to listen to.
Believe
her,
unless her name is Juanita Broderick and she says Bill Clinton raped her.
That's right. That's right.
Amen, Juanita. Sister.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much for being here. You want to share your information?
But yeah, I think he's right about something. We need more. We need more.
We'll get black people.
Racial
we'll
arguments.
Please, we'll come back on and fight with any black people.
Literally
to. No
anybody.
Problem.
Yeah. Yeah, but also we need to be informative. And I think this was.
Excellent. You just need to be a brutal racist.
Oh yeah, we have a lot of fights here. Trust me. So yeah, you want to share information?
Well, the most racist you can be is not. Most racist you can be, but quite often what's called racist is simply the nerve to treat everybody the same.
Yeah. Mm.
That, I mean, you can, over and over.
And misogynist
over,
too.
That.
It's called like you can't like if you like treat a woman. If you,
what's a misogynist?
A misogynist, someone who hates women.
I know what it is. I'm just joking.
Oh, okay, I was gonna white explain it to you.
that's what how you trick white people.
Misogynist. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know what my original point was.
At Unhireable Show on all the social
show,
media.
Yeah. Patreon.com/unhireable. Catch us on SoundCloud, iTunes.
Thank you so much for having us on.
No, this thank you guys for being here.
Yeah, and we're honored.
Noam Dorman.
And Karen knows she wrote a book, How to Break a Jewish Family's Heart.
Yeah.
Part two is coming soon.
Yeah. It's you get the goyim from outside of your body to the inside of your body. And parents hate that.
You grew up Orthodox, right?
No. Oh no, but Israeli. So we grew up kind of secular Jew, but still Jew. My family's Israeli.
Oh, I thought you were kosher.
So we were like kosher style. We went to my parents like taught at to make ends meet, like, and to pay for sin, because you know there's like fees and shit. Like taught Hebrew at the Reform.
Oh, maybe that's why.
Hebrew school.
But
so
how
we grew
Jewish?
Up kind of Reform, but also really culturally
Reform
Jewish.
Reform is like
now,
the Scientology of Judaism.
No, literally. But and they don't teach you jack shit. That like all the melodies I learned were wrong. Like it's upsetting because now my parents do the whole conservative thing, not Orthodox, but they wanted more Jew, and they're getting older and stuff. Yeah. And when I go there, I don't know. I know the prayers, but I can't sing them because
so how
the
Jewish
real
are you,
ancient
really?
Melodies are not. I'm.
Did
not,
you kill any Palestinians?
As a matter of fact.
So you are a Jew.
I'm Jewish.
Nothing.
I mean, I'm Jewish. I think the way you're Jewish. No, I'm like really, I'm Jewish. Like I'm for real Jewish. I like
no,
observe some
of
the things.
No, but
Noam
is not a real
I'm,
Jew.
But he is.
He's trying to bait me.
He's
there's
a great
not
guy.
A cell in Noam's body no, that's
no,
not
he,
Jewish.
No, Noam is a great guy. He's not a real Jew.
I've done my 23andMe. I am a real Jew. It doesn't get more Jewish.
Yeah, I'm a freaking Jew. There's like nothing in me is not Jewish. Except
no, but there's
the men
a difference for Noam and Manny. They will understand any. They will argue with you. They will. They don't listen to just to reply. They listen to understand sometimes. You know. So unlike
yeah,
a lot
like
of
said,
Jews,
huge Jew.
By the way, have you done 23andMe?
No, I'm afraid.
Have you done it?
No, I don't know
what
23andMe.
What if I'm a little Jew? What's gonna happen? How am I gonna explain this to my parents?
Listen, you call up, they send you the kit.
But, oh yeah, I want to do it though. I really want to do it.
But read the instructions.
I know I have some black in me. Wink, wink. Me too,
don't
sis.
We all, honey.
When you get the 23andMe kit, don't read the instructions. Don't make the mistake I made. You're supposed to spit in it.
Oh, not supposed to.
Oh.
It's not common sense, but that's what you're supposed to do.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, and have a great night. Live from AmericaPodcast.com. Thank you.
You were listening to Live from America Podcast. To contact us, please go to www.livefromamericapodcast.com. Brought to you by the Comedy Cellar and Rethink Production.